Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy Bookshop, your book is waiting.
Hello from the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Rogics, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 382 for Friday, April 27th, 2018. We are serving some podcast broccoli on the show today, a podcast that's good for you. Some things that engaged American citizens should know about how their president and representatives in Washington are managing the nation's finances. Donald J. Trump and the Republicans, who hold majorities in the Senate and the House, enacted tax cuts in December, and they approved a budget in March that increased spending. And those things combined will lead to greater and greater deficits. We're talking in the trillions, the T word, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Republicans, who once claimed to being prudent about fiscal matters, have pretty much given up any claim to that. And if you look at the history of deficits, it's Democrats who look fiscally responsible. New York Times columnist David Leonhardt came out and said as much on Tax Day, April 15th, quote, "Over the last few decades, Democrats have repeatedly reduced the deficit. They have raised taxes. They have cut military spending and corporate welfare. Some of them have even tried to hold down the cost of cherished social programs. Obamacare, for example, included enough cost controls and tax increases that it has cut the deficit on net." For a history of how the budget has been managed over the years, I've invited Roy Myers here, a professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Roy Myers once worked for the Congressional Budget Office, and he's an expert in the budget process. In fact, he's working on a book on that subject. He joins us for Podcast Broccoli today, the Budget and Deficit Edition, right after book critic Paula Gallagher gives us this week's recommendation.
This week's book is a nonfiction title, The New Farm, Our 10 Years on the Front Lines of the Good Food Revolution by Brent Preston. The gentleman who wrote the book is part of a Toronto couple who over 10 years ago began an organic farm in Ontario, Canada. They left city life. They wanted to get away, I guess, sort of from the rat race, but they were interested in growing good food organically. So the book is a narrative about their adventures in small-scale sustainable farming. You follow them through their years of building their farm as they plant acreage, plant things like beets and lettuces and turnip. They eventually take on more acreage. They take on farm machinery. They take on interns. They start raising some animals on a small scale, eventually taking on migrant workers to help them run their farm as it gets larger. Their whole goal is, you know, to be able to make a living, to be able to turn a modest profit, to be sustainable. And what I really liked about this book is they're real relatable people. They're not sugarcoating what it took to get where they are. And it's not one of these kind of goofy books, which I have read before, you know, city people don't realize what it's like to be farmers and follow them as they make all kinds of mistakes. They do make mistakes, and it is entertaining to read them, but there's a lot of thoughtfulness behind the narrative. And so it really brings you close to your food source as a reader. What does it take to raise animals? What does it take to bring these crops to the market? He talks about their experiences with the farmers markets and local chefs who he becomes a provider to because his produce is so good. But he also talks about the arguments he has over the cost of the produce. So another thing I liked about this book is you really see the physical labor, the stress, the emotional toll, and it makes you very appreciative of our local farmers, and it helps you to understand why things cost more at the farmer's market. You're not necessarily going there for a bargain. You're going for the relationship with that farmer and the fact that their produce is a higher quality, better taste, and really worth the extra money to bring that home, something that's local and something that's coming back into your community. Again, this is The New Farm, Our 10 Years on the Front Lines of the Good Food Revolution by Brent Preston.
Paula Gallagher is a librarian in the Baltimore County Public Library System. She recommends a book a week on Roughly Speaking, one of two podcasts of the Baltimore Sun.
Hi, I'm Quinn Kelly, and I host a weekly podcast for the Baltimore Sun called Female Trouble. Each Tuesday, we feature a new long-form conversation with one of the area's most interesting and accomplished women, from public officials and congresswomen to rappers and restaurant owners. You can find Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Find more info at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble.
Now some podcast broccoli. A podcast that's good for you. The Budget and Deficit Edition with Roy Myers, professor of political science and affiliate professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, UMBC, and he's an expert in the federal budget process. So the reason I summoned you here, Roy, and thanks for coming.
Sure.
Is because I wrote a recent column about Andy Harris, Maryland's only Republican congressman, voting for the tax cuts that came through the Congress in December, which the Congressional Budget Office says will increase deficits by $1 trillion. And then he turned around and he voted for the budget balance amendment. And I thought, there's a contradiction there. Here he is complaining about we need to get our fiscal house in order, when earlier in December he voted for tax cuts that, from everything I see, suggest that we're headed for greater deficits as a result of the tax cuts. So then I got these letters from people saying, well, where were you when Obama was increasing deficit spending, increasing the national debt? You know, all you want to do is blame Republicans for this. And then the next day, I see a column by David Leonhardt in the New York Times with the headline, "The Democrats are the party of fiscal responsibility," in which he goes over the history of deficits. And it's not that I'm confused, it's just that it would be good to talk to you to get a little perspective about this. So first of all, I mean, do you see a contradiction in someone calling for a balanced budget amendment and someone voting for those tax cuts that we saw in December, based on what you've seen and the projections you've seen from the CBO?
Oh, sure. I think everyone who pays attention to how Congress operates knows that that vote on the balanced budget amendment to the Constitution was a messaging vote, a signaling vote. It wasn't intended to pass. And
it didn't come close either.
No, you need a supermajority under the constitutional rules to pass.
Right.
And I think it got 233 positive votes, which
right.
is far below what it would need. What that bill was an attempt to provide some electoral cover for Republicans who had just, actually, unlike Harris, voted not just for the tax cut bill, but also for a significant spending increase on the consolidated or the omnibus appropriations bill.
I pointed that out in my column.
Yeah.
While he voted for the tax cuts, he also voted against the spending bill that
right.
came through with a big spending increase, domestic spending and defense spending.
Right. So, I mean, in some sense, Harris is less hypocritical than some of his fellow Republicans.
Right.
And although I think it's fair to say that there isn't much support on the Hill now in the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party for cutting spending. There certainly was great Democratic opposition to the tax cut bill. And the concern about deficits and their long-run risks that they would impose on the country is very, very low compared to what has been periods in our past. And that's pretty problematic because if you look at the CBO forecast for the next 10 years, we're going to be having deficits that exceed $1 trillion a year. The more important figure is comparing that number to the size of the economy. It's commonly measured for this purpose using the gross domestic product. And the percentages in the so-called baseline projections are about 5% a year over that 10-year period, and that's far above where we should be when the economy is growing.
As a percentage of the GDP.
Correct. If you look at our history over the past 40 years, the average deficit as a percent of GDP has been about 2.5 to 3%. It was a little lower than that, about 2 and 2.2%. Before the Great Recession. Of course, the Great Recession created a real peak in deficits for a couple of years, and they were slowly worked down during the Obama years because of the slow recovery of the economy. But now we're in a period where the economy is growing very fast, or relatively fast, and unemployment is very low. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office says that unemployment is below its natural, that unemployment is below its so-called natural rate, which means that it's likely the Federal Reserve is going to continue to increase interest rates, as it probably should. Normally, economists say that, at least most economists say, that when the economy is growing at the rate it is now, we should be reducing deficits rather than increasing them. But what we've done over this past 6 months is increase them very significantly. And that's when, over the medium term, say 20, 30 years, we face a really big problem dealing with you and I, for example, mm-hmm. the baby boomers who are aging are going to demand their Social Security benefits that they paid for.
And Medicare.
And Medicare and Medicaid, which, and more generally, looking at health costs growth across our economy, it's growing still at a rate above the growth rate of the economy. That rate has declined pretty significantly over the past number of years, and in part, in my opinion, because of the Affordable Care Act, but it's still growing too fast compared to what we can afford if you look at the medium to long-term projections. So what we should be doing as a country is reducing the deficit now rather than increasing it, but obviously Congress has gone in the opposite direction.
The main way we've increased it in the last few months is returning to the tax cuts. Tax
Correct.
Cuts for corporations from 35% to 21%. A lot of corporations weren't hardly paying any taxes anyway. But anyway, we're dropping the corporate tax rate from 35 to 21. And for individuals, temporary tax cuts. The corporate tax cuts are said to be permanent.
Yes, there's a gimmick in the tax bill in dealing with the so-called temporary status of those individual tax cuts. They phase out in years 9 and 10 of the tax bill. And the reason why they did that is that the Republicans wanted to keep the official score of the cost of the tax bill at about $1 trillion. Now, there's discussion on the Hill right now that in the House, that some Republicans want to pass another tax bill this year that would make those tax cuts permanent. And one reason when they're doing that is there's been less positive public acclaim for this tax bill than they expected would occur, which is actually predictable when you think about it. I mean, first of all—
Oh, tell me why you find that predictable, because I was a little surprised. The Republicans seem to be counting on these tax cuts being popular. They make a big fuss about corporations that give bonuses to their employees.
Right.
But that poll I saw earlier this week indicated that the public has a generally sour view of them. The tax cuts?
Well, you know, first of all, the distributional spread of the tax bill is understood by many Americans.
Apparently
now,
it is.
They know that the money is not going to be going primarily to them. It's going to be going primarily to people who have been paying higher taxes, but you know, they're going to get lower tax bills, quite significantly lower tax bills now.
Wealthier people,
yeah.
And corporations. Right.
At least, especially certain corporations. And there's actually a very important provision in this bill, the so-called pass-through provision, that gives special tax breaks to reduce the tax bill by about 20% for certain occupations and not for others. But I think one other way of thinking about why this tax bill hasn't received as much play is that people don't really quite understand that their taxes have gone down through adjustment to withholding. And we've actually saw a previous instance of this in the Obama administration under the Making Work Pay Tax Credit, which reduced the Social Security tax rate for a couple years. And people really didn't understand that. They didn't, it's somewhat surprising, but they didn't really pay much attention to their pay stubs. And President Obama, I think in a strategic mistake, didn't highlight, using his rhetoric and the power of the bully pulpit, that benefit and how it was actually helping people have more discretionary income. For
you know, I'd forgotten about it.
Yeah.
So you just mentioned this.
So there's actually a fair amount of research in political science about how people don't quite understand on their own balance sheet or their own cash flow statement, how taxes have changed for them.
So why wouldn't they be impressed with these tax cuts? Because you're saying because they actually do understand that the distribution is probably unfair.
Yeah.
Okay. So you think they understand.
So they actually are paying attention. They're paying attention to the news.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
To throw a little social science jargon at you, that's called sociotropic. People are paying attention to how people are and politicians and people in the media are interpreting this tax bill. And surprisingly, sometimes that kind of information matters more to people than their individual circumstances.
Is it also possible that we've seen this act before? You know, you were in the Congressional Budget Office during the Reagan years, right?
From 81 to 1990.
Yeah. Reagan and Bush years. So I'm thinking back to the original tax, the tax cuts that occurred during that time, and this the whole philosophy of trickle-down economics, that if that you stimulate the economy by cutting taxes for corporations, for people who have wealth and can invest it.
I think you're right in that the power of that trickle-down rhetoric is lower than it used to be. But there is a pretty significant difference between what happened in the early Reagan years and what's happened now. That is, there was a big tax cut in 1981, the Kemp-Roth tax bill, that did a number of important things. But what that led to was a pretty significant increase in the deficit. That is, we quickly understood that the supply side effects weren't occurring. And Republicans in the Senate, led by Senators Dole and Domenici, passed tax increases in 1982 and 1984 to try and keep the deficit under control. Now, actually, they failed in the sense that by about 1985, the deficit was about 5% of GDP. We're about the same level that is projected for the next 10 years. And one reason why that occurred is that while there was there were some cuts in domestic spending, there were significant increases in defense spending, which is what we're doing now as well.
Right.
By 1985, there was a lot of concern about deficits, and eventually by 1990, it led to significant changes in the budget process that helped keep deficits under control and convert them into a surplus, along with the fact of economic growth during the entire 1990s.
And looking at the history of this then, maybe throw this in. There was also an effort made, I think pretty successful, to deal with Social Security, right?
There was a commission in 1983, the Greenspan Commission.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Correct. And what that did is that it increased the normal retirement age for full benefits. And it increased payroll taxes, and it made some other changes that made it more likely that the Social Security program would be sustainable over a longer period. However, I have to say that a lot of those senators, some of the Republicans that I mentioned, like Dole and Domenici, felt that didn't go far enough. So in 1985, they actually walked out on the plank and voted for significant cuts to Social Security and Medicare, using the budget process to do that. And then President Reagan, their fellow Republican, and Tip O'Neill, the Democratic Speaker, said, no, we're not going to do that. And in response, they came up with what was called, you might remember this, the Graham-Rudman-Hollings Act.
Mm-hmm.
And that set up this first process of setting up targets for declines in the deficit. And if they weren't going to be met by Congress, there would be automatic spending cuts for a subset of programs, and they used this terrible word, sequestration.
I think it might have been the first time I heard it.
Yeah, and when you think about sequestration, you might think about, you know, putting your crazy uncle down in the basement or something. That's not what that means. In the budget process, it just means cuts to selected programs that are induced automatically by excessive deficits.
You know, there was at least a bipartisan effort back in the 80s, in the period you're talking about.
Well,
and there's always been partisanship, but now we're at a place of super partisanship.
You know? Right. Yeah, the big partisan bipartisan effort was in 1990, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the first president, Bush, President George H.W. Bush, you know, you remember he ran for the nomination for the Republican Party in 1988, and he said, read my lips, no new taxes.
Read my lips.
I'm not sure he quite believed that, and he was someone who was an old-style Republican who believed in fiscal responsibility. And similarly, on the Democratic side, there's a movement towards more fiscal responsibility that eventually led to, for example, Senator Paul Tsongas running in 1992 as a deficit hawk, and he was beaten by President Clinton, who wasn't a deficit hawk, but once President Clinton got in office, he became a real deficit hawk. So in 1990, the Congress and the president, they negotiated down at Andrews Air Force Base and agreed to pass a multi-year package that would reduce the deficit by about $500 billion, about half taxes, and about half spending cuts, tax increases, half spending cuts. And that led to the kind of super partisan, very conservative Republican approach that we see dominating the Republican Party now. That is Newt Gingrich and others.
Yeah, I was going to say.
They blame President Bush for selling out the Republican principles of lower taxes.
Yeah, the contract with America just a few years later.
Yeah. And so there, if you look at the Republican Party, you really have to go back to 1978 with Proposition 13, which was the tax rule in California, which helped push President Reagan into office, actually.
We should tell people, remind folks and those who are learning about this for the first time, what that proposition was about. That was a limit on spending, wasn't it?
Well, it was a limit on tax receipts. In other words, the government couldn't increase property taxes in particular. So when you limit the amount of money that can come in for state governments, it limits the amount of money that they can spend because they can't borrow for it.
And then other states had propositions like that too, right?
Yes, that rolled across the country, and it led towards the ethos in the Republican Party of being a low tax or a tax cutting party. One thing that President Reagan also did, though, to his credit, was he was a proponent of tax reform to make the system fairer. So there was a very important tax reform in 1986, which lowered tax rates, but did so in a deficit-neutral way, in a revenue-neutral way. That is, it didn't change the amount of taxes brought in by the country into the Treasury. But what it did is it eliminated or reduced the value of some tax preferences, or as we call them in the budget process, tax expenditures. And by doing that, you would make the system fairer, and you would also be able to reduce what we call marginal tax rates, the amount of tax imposed on the last unit of income. What's striking about this recent tax bill is that it's the opposite of that. It's not deficit neutral. It increases the deficit, and it increases inequity. It makes similarly situated people be treated very differently, like I mentioned with that pass-through income. There are certain people that are going to be able to see big reductions in their taxes and others that will not.
Larry Kudlow is the new economic advisor to President Trump. You have the CBO report in front of you, and I have it upstairs on my desk. And a lot of these projections are based on what the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says in its advisory to the Senate and the House. Kudlow says you can't believe the CBO. I forget what his exact words were, or don't believe the CBO. He said
I think he did use the word never.
Yeah. So I thought, really? Larry Kudlow, who actually thought we were going to get through the recession without having a recession, as I recall. Anyway, don't believe the CBO. I mean, I know you worked there once upon a time, but when you look over the years at the track record of this office of predicting outcomes for growth and for deficits and the debt, how is the CBO? How would you score them?
Well, to begin, I think Kudlow's position is dangerous, misguided, unfair. However, I think it is important to be skeptical of any government agency when it makes a prediction, because those predictions can be very influential, and it's important to try and get the numbers right or to try and understand what the government is saying is likely to happen. And in fact, there have been occasions when CBO has been wrong, and significantly wrong. If you look at the Affordable Care Act, for example, there are clearly areas where the CBO projections of its likely cost and the number of people covered by different parts of the Affordable Care Act were off significantly. Now, some of that's because the CBO couldn't anticipate that the Supreme Court would say that the state take up of Medicaid would be voluntary, not mandatory.
But that's pretty significant.
And some of that is due to the inevitable nature of making errors when you're trying to change a really complex sector of the economy like health and do so as dramatically as the Affordable Care Act did. However, you know, if you look at the record of CBO's projections of budget spending and of taxes and of its economic forecasts, it tends to come out very well in comparison to, first of all, the Office of Management Budget working for the president. It's less biased, and even though there's maybe about the same number of errors going in both directions, there's less bias, and it's better than the so-called blue chip forecast estimate. So what there's a firm that surveys a wide range of different forecasters and averages them out, and CBO tends to be better. So I think what we see in Kudlow's comment is a concerted campaign over the last couple of years to delegitimize the Congressional Budget Office and, for that matter, many other authorities in government or, for that matter, in the scientific world that are trying to come up with, in an unbiased way, good projections or good assessments of what is going on in the world. And I think it's terribly unfortunate. You know, we have seen times in the past when CBO has been attacked by Democrats as well. You know, for example, during 1993, 1994, the Congressional Budget Office, I think very bravely, went out and said the plan put together by Hillary Clinton has some very significant flaws in it, particularly—
You mean the health plan?
The health plan, right, mm-hmm. and particularly in how it would be administered. And Bob Reichauer, who was the director of CBO at the time and a Democrat, really made very clear that he thought that the program as proposed by the Clinton administration was unworkable. And, you know, right before he released that projection, he was lambasted by Republicans, you know, who were forecasting he was going to sell out to the Clinton administration and give it a free ride, and he didn't.
Right.
And actually, I remember when he retired, they handed out buttons at the retirement party, which was a picture of a skunk. The role of the Congressional Budget Office is to be the skunk of the garden party to try and say, okay,
This isn't going to work,
or at least let's think about some of the possible risks. Mm-hmm. And so what CBO is doing now is what it should be doing, is saying we have a problem over the medium to long term. Not immediately. We can go out and borrow the money. It's easy for the United States government to borrow money now. But if we continue on the path that we're going, we are going to have some significant problems. And we should start thinking about that instead of just ignoring those potential risks.
What is the problem with running up the national debt to, at this projection from the CBO, something like, what, $30 trillion or more than that over the next decade? Sorry if that sounds like a sophomore question. I just don't want to take for granted that we understand what the problem is in having such a large debt.
Well, you know, it actually turns out it's not a sophomore question. It's a good question to ask. Every citizen should learn something about this and not be misled by a number of simplistic positions that can be taken by people on the left, the right, or the center. It's actually a very complicated problem. When you think about what the government is doing when it is borrowing money, it's making a promise to pay people back later for the money the government's receiving now. And if what the government does is with those borrowing proceeds is to invest in the economy and make it stronger in the future, then actually that borrowing is a pretty good idea, isn't it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if it's borrowing to help people become more productive in the economy as workers, to reduce the kind of problems that they have so we wouldn't have to support them in the future, or to build infrastructure, for example, all those are good purposes, as is, for example, keeping the national security of the United States strong. We had, you know, a very high debt at the end of World War II, and for good reason. We fought off the Nazis, right? But if that continues, if you continue to do that year after year after year, and the money that you spend actually doesn't have those positive effects, then you'd have a weaker economy, and you'd have to pay off that higher debt year after year after year out of a lower amount of income in the whole country. And that's the kind of risk that we could face in the future.
And is one of the problems that U.S. debt becomes less valued, that, you know, U.S. bonds are become less valued over time, the more debt we accrue and the less reward we see coming back from the economy?
That is a concern, although the United States is in a very special position compared to many other countries. If you look at many other countries, when they borrow too much, they have what's called a sovereign debt crisis. That is, lenders are unwilling to buy those countries' bonds. You know, for example, Greece went through that,
right,
and for understandable reasons, because Greece was not going to be able to service its debt given the low rate of growth of the economy and the high level of debt. The United States has what a Berkeley economist, Barry Eichengreen, calls an exorbitant privilege. We're a very rich country. We're a big, rich country, and we have, relative to many other countries, a pretty stable political system. And
could that ever happen? Could that happen in the United States?
Could the United States have a sovereign debt crisis?
Yeah,
yeah, sure. But no one can credibly say when that will happen.
Hmm.
I think the more important problem to think about is that we're actually going to face problems earlier than that sovereign debt crisis.
Yeah, because tell me what you're thinking.
Because think about right now. What happens when the economy is rolling along and then the federal government adds to that by reducing taxes and increasing spending, which means it has to borrow more because of that bigger deficit? Well, the government goes out in the bond market, and it can promise to pay you back with a much stronger promise than many corporations can make, because the United States government's a pretty strong going concern. It can raise taxes if it needs to. But those corporations, they may not have that kind of strong position.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that the government will be able to borrow more from a restricted pool of savings than some of those corporations would. That's called crowding out. And it means that private companies will have less money available to make investments, and that will, over the long run, make them less competitive, the United States economy less competitive. Now, over the past decade, we haven't had that crowding out problem at all, right? Because of the Great Recession, and it's been reflected in the low level of interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're about to see is the possibility of crowding out, particularly when you think about it. You know, if you look at that CBO report that you read, it shows that this stimulus that we're putting into the economy now with the tax cuts and the spending increases are increasing the rate of growth of the economy above its so-called potential rate. And when that happens, that's a signal to the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates. And then that makes it harder for people in the private sector who are dependent upon low interest rates
to raise capital.
To raise capital. And for mm-hmm. that matter, young people to buy their first homes, because mortgage interest rates will eventually reach the point where they won't be able to afford the compounding of that higher interest rate over a 30-year mortgage period.
Mm-hmm.
So again, the real question, though, is how is this money being used? Is the tax system being set up to fairly incentivize people to work and save? And for that matter—
Well, for companies to invest?
Right.
To broaden their workforce,
right,
for instance? Better pay for workers?
Right. And on the spending side, is each dollar that the federal government's spending being used to efficiently promote outcomes that we want in this society? And so then the question should become, on the spending side, how well is the government allocating money to program after program or across the different sectors as government? And that's as serious a problem to think about as is the longer run risk of having excessive deficits, which could reduce the growth rate of the economy and increase the amount of money that would have to come out of the spending side of the budget to pay for the interest on that debt. Because when you think about it, the crowding out is also within the government's budget, in that if you are going to have to pay higher and higher interest to the bondholders over the next 20, 30 years, that means there's going to be less money available to pay for things we all want, like national security or education or social services, feeding kids mm-hmm. for school lunches, whatever.
Mm-hmm. The part of the David Leonhardt piece that I appreciated was we're reluctant to say, well, the Democrats are better than the Republicans on this. We try to be fair and objective and not sound like you pick a side or make some declaration that one political party has done better at something than another. But he decides it's time to stop that because when you look at the history of deficits and the budgets over the years, Democratic administrations and Congresses have done better than Republicans. I mean, I hate to bottom line this, but he did provide a graph showing that. And do you generally agree with that? When you look back over, well, since Proposition, what was it, the California?
Proposition 13.
Proposition 13. Yeah. And then there was 2.5 in Massachusetts. That's the other one I remember.
Right.
But if you go from like the late 70s, or even back during the time of Gerald Ford in the 70s forward, do you generally agree with that assessment of that history?
As an academic, of course, I'm prone to trying to bring up some of the complexities that other people might miss. Mm-hmm. But I think the simple point that Leonhardt makes and that a number of media commentators have made is that to give an accurate description of what has happened in the budget in the past 30-some years, you can't simply say the problem is due to both parties. In fact, it's due to one party for certain aspects of the problem and to the other party for certain aspects of the problem. And in fact, both parties include a number of leaders who have actually tried to reduce the problem. For example, Senator Domenici, a Republican, I think has a well-earned reputation for being a responsible budget leader within the Republican Party. And there are other members of the Democratic Party that wouldn't have that reputation. Mm-hmm. Now, as an academic, as a professor, I understand where Leonhardt is coming from because in the classroom, it's sometimes difficult to teach a course like a budgeting course without reaching a similar assessment that Leonhardt has reached, which is that at least on the topic of the combined topics of deficit reduction and tax cuts, Republicans have taken inconsistent positions. When they have been in power, they have jettisoned some of their balanced budget rhetoric, and they have cut taxes as much as possible, increasing the long-run deficit. And when they have been out of power, they have blamed Democrats for any increases in the deficit. Democrats, of course, this is a very hyper-partisan environment in the United States, spent a lot of time trying to generate blame on the Republican Party as well. And there have been times when they haven't contributed to improving the budget process either. Now, maybe one way we could close this is mentioning that I think there's widespread recognition in Washington that this is an unsustainable situation we're in. And there's in the so-called Bipartisan Budget Act of 2018, which is, I think, a somewhat ironic name.
Yeah.
There was a creation of a special committee called the Joint Select Committee on Budget and Appropriations Process Reform, which is supposed to report its findings by November 30th, and it's constituted of 8 Democrats, 8 Republicans, 8 senators, 8 House of Representatives members. I am not that confident that they're going to come up with much of value, but I do think that they're going to make a few recommendations that will make some net improvements in the process. But more importantly, I think it's a signal that the budget process and its poor design and implementation is higher on the agenda than it has been in the past. So I expect in the next couple of years, there's going to be much more attention to this issue. And I hope that as a society, we'll make some improvements that will benefit all of us over the long run. What that will require, however, is that it's not just members of Congress that learn about this topic, but it's citizens as well. And they have to not only learn a little bit more about it, but make some decisions on the basis of what they do know.
Well, there's evidence that they're paying attention.
Yeah.
As you alluded to earlier, when it comes to the tax cuts and the polling showing that they're not as popular as Republicans had hoped.
Right.
Yeah. People are paying attention. And this has been helpful, too, very much.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Roy Myers is professor of political science and affiliate professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. and an expert in the federal budget process, is working on a book on that subject. That's our show for now. Your thoughts are welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please tell your friends about the show. And if you get a chance, review this podcast on iTunes. Our producers are Steve Early and Quinn Kelly. I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.